This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues, Richard Pollock,
and Ezra Ginsberg.
Producer Tim gets us on and off the air, like the expert that he is. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. We'll break down the Jets-Canucks game in its entirety. We'll preview the Jets-Canadians game tomorrow afternoon on this fine station. And we'll just touch base on the Jets' remaining schedule and what it's going to take for this team to be a playoff team. That, along with all the other news in the NHL world. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. Without further ado, I say a good afternoon to my colleagues, Richard and Ezra. Gentlemen, a good afternoon. How are you both?
Doing well. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'm really liking that new intro here. I'm pumped up. No more Beastie Boys, but it's a nice little intro that was put together for us. So, big win for the Jets last night. And, you know, we won't have a home game for a while here, but that was a big win. It was an exciting game. So, glad to be here talking about it.
Richie?
Yeah, no, I echo those sentiments, Drew, and last night's game had a kind of a different vibe to it, really. It was a good game, a quick game. I mean, the pace was good, the skating, there wasn't a lot of whistles. Mm-hmm. Went by quite quickly. I didn't have that same emotion that Leafs game did last week, although it's hard to replicate that game. But still, a good win for the Jets. That came through when it mattered, and only 6 points out of the playoffs.
Exactly right. Let's start by breaking down last night's game. The Jets opened the scoring. They really came out a house on fire, as the cliche saying goes. They opened the scoring at the 5:02 mark of the first period. Zach Bogosian gets his third of the year, assist to Toby Enstrom and Andrew Ladd, and it's, you know, Zach Bogosian, we know he's got a cannon for a shot. It's when he gets it on net, and that tends to be the problem more than not. This time he got it on net, and the Jets jumped out to an early 1-0 lead.
Yeah, Drew, what happened on this goal and then the first goal of the game there is the Jets were moving the puck on the perimeter, and the Ladd gets the puck over to Enstrom. It happens to be that Enstrom and Bogosian are flipped on sides, meaning that Bogosian's on his off wing, more apt to be able to take a one-timer.
Sure.
And he, of course, that's exactly what happens here. But the Jets are moving the puck on the perimeter, which is Vancouver's kind of playing, you know, you want to keep the puck on the outside. But Vancouver does, I'm not going to say well, because I didn't think they played well in the defensive zone yesterday at all, is they collapse low. And Bogosian's, the winger who's tasked with coming out on Bogosian was low. Yannick Hansen, he doesn't get out in time. Bogosian's got a good release and a good shot, and the puck gets out to Bogosian. One-timer, it's in the back of the net. Good execution by the Jets.
Yeah, it's nice. Bogo's had a tough year, let's be honest, offensively. I think he's really started to shine defensively. And over the last two and a half weeks, especially since the coaching change, I think Bogo and Enstrom have done a very good job, and the Jets are winning. And I think that aspect of his game I have no problems with. But Bogosian only has 3 goals now, and it's nice for him to get on the score sheet, because I think he's not even at 10 points on the season right now. And it was a nice shot, and you know, Richie talks about the defense, and without Chris Tanev and Kevin Bieksa there, and also Andrew Alberts, who's really a spare defenseman, but especially Bieksa and Tanev, the Canucks were really lacking a presence back there. And Dan Hamhuis had a great game, I thought, and he was throwing his body around, and Edler's still an excellent defenseman, but you had Frankie Corrado in there. And Ryan Stanton, I didn't think, had one of his best games. And the Jets were really doing a good job of really getting in there. And kind of, I thought the Jets played a pretty simple game. And I think, you know, they were able to capitalize on some chances there. And the Canucks really, you take those two guys out of the lineup and you really see how their depth is really stretched. And they don't have the depth that they've had in past years. And I think the Jets really took advantage of that, and I think there were times in the game, in the Kessler line, I thought played really well. Kessler, Sedin, and Cassie, and I thought they did a really good job there, Richie. Mm-hmm. And Kessler, obviously, going into the game, only had a goal in 11 games, and he really broke out for 3 points.
Yeah, he was excellent.
Unfortunately, they didn't get the win, which all the Canucks want right now is a win, because they're dangerously close to falling out of relevance this playoff race.
You were in that room last night. Talk about that.
Well, that team right now, I think they're in a stretch of 10 losses in 15 games, something like that. And right now it's troubling because
that was the mood was down or what?
Oh, it was an absolutely down room. Yeah, the team right now, first game of a 5-game road trip right now, and they're sliding. Yeah. And you look at Daniel Sedin. Since Henrik Sedin went out of the lineup, you know how many points Daniel Sedin has? Zero. Doesn't have a point in 5 games. And if you think that he's not affected by not having his brother there, it's a unique situation with the Sedins.
Yeah, it is.
Because you have two twins, by far the best twins combination of all time. Like, there's nothing close. Like, no offense to the Sutters, but they're not at that level. And those
aren't
guys,
you the Sutter twins?
Yeah, they were just brothers. I don't think they're twins.
I thought they were twins. Rich and Dwayne?
I don't know.
Yeah, there was enough of them. They could be twins.
Primus was here. We'd get to be able to check.
I thought there were Sutter twins, but the point being that I don't think anybody's played at that level, and they really feed off of each other. And, you know, right now there's so many issues. I think this team is prime for a move right now. I think they need more offense. They need more secondary offense. And right now, really in the last week or so, it's been Chris Higgins that's really been providing most of their offense. And they have a lot of players. Santarelli's out for the season. He was having a good year. This team really needs more offense because they're really lacking there. And you can see that a guy like Henrik Sedin, by the way, he's supposed to come back before the Olympics. He's supposed to play in the Olympics. But over the last 5 games, they've just been really struggling to score.
3 goals that they scored last night would be an offensive explosion for this team. It wasn't enough for them. The Jets made it 2-0 at the 6:07 mark of the first period. So they got 2 goals within a minute and 5 seconds. Devin Setoguchi, who we've riled on this show, deservingly so, had a very good game for the Jets last night.
Best game of the year.
Yeah, it was best game of the year.
He had no question about that.
No, that was, I mean, he was noticeable. And so
he was really good yesterday, Drew.
Yeah. He gets his 9th goal of the year. It's an assist to Dustin Byfuglien and Mark Scheifele. The play starts with a great pass from Scheifele to Byfuglien. Byfuglien with the vision to see Setoguchi all alone in front of Eddie Lack, and he makes no mistake, puts it in the net.
Yeah, the play actually starts on the forecheck when Mark Scheifele comes in with speed, something that he's really improved at, on two defensemen. So Scheifele on his own comes in on Hamhuis and Weber and ends up with the puck. And when you can come in on a forecheck with one forward on two defensemen, you can come up with the puck, you're doing something right. And he curls around, he sees Byfuglien, there's a blown coverage there. Byfuglien cuts in down the right side, and Byfuglien has great vision. And Byfuglien finds Setoguchi, is on his off wing, and Setoguchi puts the puck in the net. But, you know, Dan Hamhuis can't be losing that battle to Mark Scheifele. And Yannick Weber's a little bit of a disaster in his own zone. There was another blown coverage there. But Scheifele makes that whole play. And, I mean, Byfuglien obviously makes the pass across, but Scheifele on the forecheck, and then that beautiful pass to Byfuglien was you know, 2-0 right there. Great play.
I was really impressed. Setoguchi got the first star, but I was really impressed also the way he was throwing his body around. He was all over the ice. For him, last game, he made a terrible error. And, you know, for Setoguchi, he needs a game like that because he has really struggled this year. And he's had moments. He's had moments where he's produced offensively, but really he needed that game. And I was really impressed with his all around effort. He deserved the first star. And for the Jets, when you have, I mean, really, guys, the fourth line has not been used a lot. So, and they've really been relying on two lines. And as of late, it's really been the Scheifele Wheeler line, whether that's Kane on that line or Thorburn on that line, really, because the lad little Frolik line hasn't been really producing at the level they have been basically all year. And it's really nice to see because Setoguchi has a strong game, and I thought Pavlik was good. It was really all around a really good effort from the Jets, and a win that they needed in the sense that not only are they trying to keep up with the pack in the Western Conference, but you're not going to be at home for basically a month, fans on a Friday night. And I thought the fans were awesome last night, especially in that third period. We saw the BC Sucks chant, but I think it was a great send-off for the fans who aren't going to see their team for a month.
Vancouver got the first power play of the game. They also got the first power play goal of the game. That came at the 10:27 mark of the first period. Alex Edler gets the goal, assist to Alex Burrows and Ryan Kessler. Chris Thorburn's in the box for a offensive zone holding penalty against Frank Corrado.
Yeah, you know, Drew, I know it doesn't look good, the offensive zone holding penalty, but he's getting in on the forecheck. He shouldn't have grabbed the jersey there, tried to get around him, but it's not from a lack of effort with Chris Thorburn, and if that happens all the time, I'd be more concerned. But he was just working hard and trying to create. So I'm not going to get faulted too hard for that penalty.
Yeah, and then it's just a pass across the crease. Alex Edler's wide open there, and he is able to put it past Andre Pavlik.
Well, I mean, the play starts with Sedin on the half wall there, the half boards, excuse me, and he kind of makes a shot pass to Kessler, and Kessler makes a nice tip. And then when Trouba comes out to kind of confront Sedin, Stewart has to rotate over, and then Frolik has to rotate because Edler's in the back door, right? As Edler kind of comes around the back door and sneaky, and Frolik just lost him for a second, and because they all rotated from kind of into a diamond formation there for a second, Frolik has to have that coverage, but wasn't the worst defensive execution. The puck just bounced over there too, so... you know, a tough goal against, but not something where you go, oh my God, what an awful play by a defender, by a forward.
Right. At the end of the first period, it was Jets 2, Vancouver Canucks 1, but it took at the 4:48 mark of the second period, the Canucks were able to tie the game. Ryan Kessler with a backhand, unassisted on this one, turnover in the Jets zone. And we mentioned Kessler earlier when we were breaking down this game. He was the best Vancouver Canuck forward on the ice last night.
Yeah, he was, and he came out of the corner and kind of was trying to direct a shot at net, and then Brian Little was kind of in the middle. That was a play that Brian Little wishes he had back, because the puck was on his stick, and he kind of coughed it up there, and Kessler really just followed through with it and almost just powered his way through that, kind of willed that puck in, really. And, you know, this is the Ryan Kessler that was so dominant in 2011 when the Vancouver Canucks went to the finals against the Boston Bruins and almost won their first ever Stanley Cup. Kessler was excellent. You know, kind of funny that the first couple of goals were ex-Moose guys, because I think there was 8 ex-Moose guys in the lineup for the Vancouver Canucks. We know how many Manitoba Moose products ended up going to the Vancouver Canucks system. But that was a nice goal. Kessler was a force last night.
Yeah, he was a force. And what he's trying to do in the original leave, Kessler turns a corner, tries to make a pass, and Bogosian, it hits off Bogosian, and then the puck pops into the middle. Little grabs it and tries to make a move. And if Little had it back, as you mentioned, he'd like to, you know, probably just put that puck off the boards or just get it, fire it out. And he makes a move. Kessler steals it back. He kind of misses on the stick check. And then Kessler comes in on his backhand, puts a nice backhand glove side. But to me, Pavlik's got to have that puck.
He fought the puck last night, Pavlik, I thought. He got the win, so I'm not going to criticize the guy too badly, but I thought that a few times during the game, and I was in my seat, so I mean, I sort of had a different vantage point, and there were a few times, especially in that second period, where he was unsure of where the puck was, and he looked like he was fighting it, at various times there.
Yeah, I didn't think it was the sharpest game. I thought that you could probably take an issue with goals 2 and 3. One I wouldn't really fault him on.
Yeah, one is
three
one
is still, but three. Garrett, we'll talk about the third goal. But he's had worse games. But I didn't think yesterday was his best ever by any means. He could have been better for sure.
To their Jets' credit, it took him less than 2 minutes to regain the lead. Michael Frolik gets his 11th of the year. Assists to Andrew Ladd and Brian Little on this one. What did you see on this goal?
Well, talking about Brian Little, how he was, at fault a little bit. Well, not at fault. He was at fault. I really was really impressed the way Brian Little responded right after that. Well, a couple shifts after that, the next shift, I should say, after that. Because Brian Little, you could see he was upset. He was not happy with himself. And that line came back down the ice. And really, it was a beautiful passing play from Ladd to Frolik. Really nice pass. And, you know, that line, as we talked about, they haven't been lighting it up lately. So it was really nice for them to come right back. Because to me, that I realized Jason Garrison, you know, scores, gets that power play goal. Sorry, it wasn't on the power play in the third period there. And, you know, they tie the game up. But for me, that was kind of a turning point, really, in the game, that Vancouver came back, tied it. And then Ladd, Little, and Frolik went down the ice. Really a nice tic-tac-toe play. And it was a nice goal. Frolik, you know, converted, and I really was impressed with that. To me, that was a response from kind of poor play in your own zone. So to me, that was probably the nicest goal of the night.
We'll break down the goal to 1 second. I thought Eddie Lack was great last night.
He was fantastic.
He went in 4 goals, but that certainly wasn't an indication.
And he's been great all year.
Yeah, how
he's
played.
He's been solid all year.
He was excellent. On this play, Little actually comes in the zone, fires it around the boards, the far boards, all the way to Ladd. Ladd fires it all the way back to Little, and Little puts it back to Ladd, and Ladd had come around from the left side of the offensive zone to the right side to support. And when Little makes that play to Ladd, Frolik pops into the slot, and he's on his strong side, so it's not the easiest shot. And the Canucks have 4 guys in their defensive zone right around Frolik. This is one of those goals that Mike Sullivan is going to go crazy about. And Frolik pops into the middle of those four guys. Nobody takes him. Lab makes a nice pass. Frolik makes a takes a nice shot. And it's 3-2.
Let's go to break. And when we come back, we'll break down the third period. And then we'll do. And then we'll look at the game on the overall. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, breaking down last night's Jets-Canucks game. The Jets, of course, victors by a 4-3 margin. Before the break, we had just finished the second period where the Jets had a 3-2 lead after 40 minutes. That didn't last too long. Actually, it lasted I shouldn't say that it didn't last too long, but the Canucks were able to tie it up at the 11:50 mark of that third period. Jason Garrison with the slap shot from the point, assist to Ryan Stanton, and Ryan Kessler getting his third point of the evening for the Canucks. And I got to tell you, boys, at that point in time, 11:50 mark, I sort of thought, okay, well, this is a three-point game. You know, both teams are going to play for the three-point game at that point. But I was pleasantly surprised. But we'll get to that in a minute. What did you see on this goal?
You know, on the Garrison goal here, Drew, I mean, Andrew Ladd doesn't get the puck out earlier in the play, and that's significant because you got to get that puck out, and he didn't. And the puck gets back to Stanton, as you mentioned, and he makes a cross-ice pass to Garrison. Garrison has arguably the top 3-1-timer in the National Hockey League, and if people were watching closely last night, or not even that closely, there's a couple of shots that he got off, you're like, wow, that was pretty impressive. So Frolik probably needs to be a little closer to Garrison, taking into account how good he is on the one-timer in his off-wing there. But Ladd really should get that puck out earlier, and it should never have happened. In terms of Pavlik, yeah, I know a clear shot from the point. Was the screen that big? I mean, I've watched it a few times, and I don't know, but
I thought the screen was more to his side than it was directly in front of him.
That's kind of how I feel as well. So probably one it was. It's probably one that he wants back as well.
Yeah, and Jason Garrison had another bomb from the point after Jacob Trouba took that tripping penalty.
Yeah.
And then that one was even strength. But you're right, Richie. He's got one of the best cannons in the entire league, and he's been very good for them this year. I think Garrison has improved defensively a lot. I think last year he didn't have the best year after he came over from Florida, but he's improved his defensive game and has become a shutdown defenseman. He's added that element to his game because, again, he came into the NHL later. He wasn't a guy that, you know, who came into the NHL right out of junior or right out of the AHL. He had to really make a name for himself that way, and it was a nice goal. He's got a great shot, and you know, he's going to be a huge part of that team. We're not sure how long BX and Tanev are going to be out, and you know, he's one of those guys that'll have to increase his minutes and all that.
Marty St. Louis being awarded a penalty shot right now. The Habs playing the Lightning in the typical Saturday afternoon game before they play their traditional Sunday afternoon game against the Jets tomorrow. So Marty St. Louis about to get a penalty shot. The Jets were able to get the game-winning goal at the 17:04 mark of the third period. Devin Setoguchi gets into double figures with goals on the year. Assist to Jacob Trouba. This is on a delayed penalty after Alex Burrows takes a high sticking penalty in the Jets zone. Setoguchi coming off the bench and gets hit by the pass by Trouba and puts it past Lack.
Well, when you have a delayed penalty, you have a little more freedom to kind of do what you want to do. But Trouba here just is great because he leads the rush, but then he stops on a dime just over the blue line and allows the play to kind of develop for himself, right? You have four guys coming back for the Canucks, but when he's a great skater. When he stops, everybody flows by him. He cuts to the middle a bit, waits for the trailer, gets it over to Setoguchi. Setoguchi puts a nice shot blocker side, and Wheeler makes a nice screen. Good execution here, guys, and just such great poise by Trouba and Scheifele overall. And again, the young guys are driving the bus here. So if you're a Jets fan, you got to be happy about the win. And you got to be happy about, you know, what they can do in the future. So all in all, it was a good execution. You get Setoguchi gets two. So, you know, his confidence is up. And boy, does it. And as I'll let you get in here, but boy, is it a change when the Byfuglien was going last night too. Jokinen wasn't great, but Byfuglien was going. And when Byfuglien and Setoguchi are going, giving these guys the three lines to score, night and day in terms of how hard it is to defend the squad.
Yeah, and it was a huge goal for Setoguchi. We've already mentioned that. Huge two goals, really, but that goal especially, the game winner. And Jacob Trouba deserves two assists, really, for that, because he really jumps up into the play and really just, again, shows how good his wheels really are. And you mentioned Blake Wheeler with the screen. It was good execution. And, you know, after that, the party was on at the MTS Center. And there was no looking back after that. Vancouver didn't really muster up much of anything in the last couple minutes there. Huge goal. And again, the Jets are now in a position where they can go into Montreal and hopefully win some more games before the Olympic break.
And we'll break down the Jets and the Habs coming up in the next segment. You know, overall, it's sort of that was a must-win game for the Jets. When you look at the standings and you look at how they laid the egg on Tuesday night against Nashville in what is a game that they probably wanted to have back, you're trailing the Canucks, you know, in the standings in the race for the last playoff spot in the Western Conference. You're on home ice. It's the last game before, you know, a month away from the arena, as he was saying. It's a game that you must have, and the Jets were able to win, and what's more important than the win, or just as important in the win, as far as I'm concerned, is that it was a clean win, not a three-point game. They got the full 2 points against the Canucks last night.
Yeah, I don't know if they just quickly on the Nashville. I don't know if they laid the egg against Nashville. They didn't play their best game, but they didn't play their worst game. I thought Nashville played a good game there. I think people don't like to give Nashville credit, but I thought Nashville played a good game. But last night, you're right, they took advantage of a team that is a bit in shambles right now. Injury-wise, I think overall, like, where are they? What are they? You know, that's kind of the question to ask. What is that team? You heard TSN last night during the breaks. A team in transition, a team willing to reset, to do some different things. So we were talking about it before the show, and we're going to talk about it later. What do they do? But you could see it in the way they played, I thought, Ezzy. I thought Kessler imposed his will on the game as much as he possibly could. But similar to times in the past, nobody else really stepped up, I didn't think. And he didn't have that help in a big game for them. And the Jets took advantage of them. The Jets played a more confident game, I thought, than Vancouver last night. Like, I thought when the Jets played last night, they thought they were going to win. And I don't think they necessarily have had that mindset in the past. So I was impressed. I thought it was a good effort. They deserved to win. I don't think there's any question about that. Eddie Lack, a couple big saves on Bufflin there. On Scheifele, a couple big saves on Scheifele. Mm-hmm. Who knows? I mean, it could have been 6-7-3 the way they were going.
Right. You mentioned you don't really know where the Vancouver Canucks are at. And that might be why the assembled media, myself included, were waiting for Mike Sullivan for 25 minutes after the game. I wouldn't be surprised if he was on the phone with Torts talking about that game, because
not allowed to be. No contact.
What about the cardboard cutout of Torts? Was he there in the scrum?
Didn't they allow? What do you mean no contact?
John Tortorella is not allowed to have any contact with the team while he has been suspended.
Oh, okay.
Are they going to check his cell phone logs to see if he's texting Mike Sullivan?
I didn't realize you couldn't talk on the phone.
Hey, don't look at me. I'm not the one making up the rules, but that's what the NHL imposed when he was suspended. The cardboard Tortorella was pretty funny.
Let me ask you this. Okay. Last night was the last game of his suspension, so does his suspension end exactly the end of the game, Drew?
I don't know. Fair point, Richard. Maybe maybe he was immediately eligible after the end of the game.
I think the point,
as he should have called him if that was the case.
I think the point being was that they were having a meeting after the game, and it's really not good right now in Vancouver, because this team is in a position right now. I don't think that anybody was expecting the Vancouver Canucks to finish first in the Western Conference right now, but this is a critical road trip for them, and it didn't start off well, and they didn't get the effort that they wanted yesterday. I think the way Daniel Sedin played yesterday was a big concern, because, as I said, he can be lost at times. It's not that he can't be productive without Henrik Sedin, but they rely on each other so much. They've played with each other their entire lives, and right now it's nice to see that Kessler's going, but again, you know, you're always going to be strong in goal and on defense right now, but again, I wouldn't be surprised if a move happens even before the roster freeze.
It just goes to show how thin Vancouver was on the back end last night. First of all, they lost Yannick Weber early in the game. He only played 3.5 minutes in the game. Dan Hamm, who's played 29 minutes and 15 seconds last night.
He was excellent last night.
That's a workload and a half.
It is a workload and a half. He had like one 3-minute shift too, where he couldn't get off the ice. He was just trapped in his own zone. That's tough, Drew. But for a team that can't score, I almost think the Sedin loss is bigger than anything. I realize he hasn't been what he's been past years.
Sure.
But, I mean, did you notice Daniel Sedin more than a couple of times last night? It wasn't on the power play?
The only time I noticed him is when he was skating to the dressing room to get a skate sharpened right before, I think it was right before the third period power play. He came back on the ice and he was only wearing one skate because he had just gone to get it sharpened. But other than that, he was fairly invisible.
He had that 2-on-1 where he took the shot, Ezzy. And I think when you see him, if you watch Daniel Sedin in the past, that's not the kind of play he does. He likes to make plays, and he's just trying to simplify the game. And when you're trying to simplify the game, that means you're not going as you usually are.
But I think Ezzy does make a good point that, you know, when you lose one Sedin, you almost lose the other one because they're so, you know, in tune with one another. You know, the twin telepathy or whatever they like to call it.
Very good point. And they have a lot of other guys that are complementary players who have been thrust into roles that they relied on to score on a nightly basis, and that's too much pressure.
You look at a guy like Alex Burrows again,
and that's
former Manitoba Moose.
Crazy.
Scored
a goal.
In 2011, huge part of that team. You remember all the big goals that Alex Burrows scored for the Canucks in the playoffs there.
Overtime winner.
That overtime winner was one of the biggest goals in that franchise's history. And he's struggling big time. He's had a bunch of injury problems. He's missed half of the season, more than half of the season this
year. He has 4 assists in 24 games. Like, that is unbelievable.
He's having a really rough year. And there are other guys as well having rough years. And, you know, again, a guy like David Booth, who was acquired 2 years ago to fill that role, it hasn't worked. Too. And that's why you're hearing all of these, it's Vanek, Camilleri, all these guys. Again, you know, I don't think it's a bold prediction to say that the Vancouver Canucks make a move within the next week, because something's got to change. And we know Torts is coming back, and, you know, but personnel, I think, needs to change, because you have a team right now that is very much in danger of missing the playoffs, and the Canucks can't afford to miss the playoffs.
And I'll tell you one thing, I mean, they can't score, but if you're not going to be able to score, I mean, this is just my observation, but if you're not going to be able to score, you best defend. And if you watch that team in their own zone yesterday, that was a nightmare. I mean, they were running around like chickens with their head cut off. I wasn't impressed with their penalty kill. Their defensive zone coverage was awful. They were out of position. They were following the puck. I mean, if you're not going to be able to score, you better be able to defend. And last night, I mean, that's only one game, and I understand that, but that was not an impressive performance in their back end. And Eddie Lack, as we've mentioned now a number of times throughout the beginning of the show, saved a couple of goals, guys, because there were some grade-A scoring chances that didn't go in.
Well, the Jets had 15 shots there in the first period, and they could have easily been up 3 or 4-1 after one period. And right, Eddie Lack was the difference and kept that game close for them. It allowed them to, you know, Kessler to score the goal to tie it up, and it allowed Garrison to tie the game up for a second time. Yeah, he deserved his star. Did he get a star last night?
No.
No. Okay. Kessler got it. The stars were Setoguchi 1, Kessler 2, and I believe Scheifele 3.
Yep.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll look forward to tomorrow afternoon's game between the Jets and the Montreal Canadiens. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Listen online at TSN1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit RumorsComedyClub.com. Tonight, his final night in town, Daryl Lennox. He has been absolutely selling out the club every single night. The 7:15 p.m. show tonight is already sold out. Some tickets, not very many, still available for the 10 p.m. show. So you can check out Daryl Lennox tonight. And of course, next week at Rumors, comedy hypnotist, and he follows Ezzy on Twitter, the Incredible Boris.
Yeah, he's awesome. If you have a chance to check him out, definitely check him out.
Jets and the Montreal Canadiens will do battle tomorrow afternoon, 12 noon, the Habs' traditional Super Bowl Sunday game. The Jets will be making their first visit this year to the Bell Centre to see the Habs, the first and only visit. Habs are currently in action playing the Tampa Bay Lightning, scoreless tie so far there. The Jets have had one win in the 3 years they've been back against the Habs, so not a ton of success. You know, how do they match up against the Habs in tomorrow night's game? Richie, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it's a skating game, Drew. That's what you're dealing with. You're dealing with two teams that can fly, really. And how do you deal with their speed? Montreal is going to come at you. I mean, the teams are actually pretty similar. The Jets are obviously a little bit bigger than the Habs, but they're both can move, and they both have lines. I don't know that the Jets are kind of structured the way they are as. You know, granted, Kane's injured, but they both have, you know, a few lines, three lines that can get at you. So it's a balanced attack, and I wonder if you'll see a lot of matchup play, or I think very possibly you'll see the teams kind of roll through these lines and let them go at each other and see what happens. And that would be obviously a benefit to the Jets with the Habs having last change.
Right, and the Canadians have won their last two games here, but they've really struggled, especially in the month of January here, and they've started to pick it up as of late, and you had a guy like Danny Briere, who was a healthy scratch. Now he's starting to contribute. David Desharnais had a very tough start to the season, and middle part of the season, he's starting to come along now, and, you know, the Montreal Canadiens, you know, sitting in fifth place there, 1 point behind the Leafs, and they've got the Jets coming into town, and You know, they're playing, you know, the first of a back-to-back right now in front of us. But, you know, the Montreal Canadiens have really kind of fallen off because they were kind of competing for a home playoff spot. They still are, I guess, in the sense that it's, you know, you still have 28 games left. But, you know, the Canadiens, to me, another guy that has kind of had troubles offensively this year, Max Pacioretty, and he's been better as of late. So, you know, the Canadiens are always tough. And to me, the troubling thing for me this year is Andre Markov has not been good, and PK Subban has really had to really almost play more than right. in past seasons. But Andre Markov has not had a good year defensively. He's looked slow at times, and Alexei Emelin has really come back, and he's kind of taking a little bit of time to get back to his previous form. But, you know, the Canadiens are a great team. You mentioned their speed. They can really kill you with their speed. And Lars Eller, Galchenyuk, and Gallagher, a player that I really like, those guys can hurt you, and they can hurt you with many lines. And I think they're still looking for a little bit more toughness, and that's a concern for them going into the playoffs. And we talked about it on the midweek show. There was a rumor that they were going to try to acquire Parenteau for Bork, and to me that's not a good move, because Bork is one of those guys that kind of offers that physical element, and Parenteau is another scorer. But, you know, the Habs are still a strong team, and I think, you know, this past little stretch has been awful. They were calling for Michel Therrien to be fired at Montreal. I thought that was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things to look at is Markov and Subban aren't playing together, you know, right. now. And when you look at what they've done, they've put Emelin with Markov, I think, to try. And as he mentioned, Emelin's had a tough time kind of coming back from the injuries. We talked to Pat Hickey when we filled in Hauser and Lawless. He said as much. Try and settle both of those guys down, I think. Subban with Georges. Georges is going to be your rock-solid stay-at-home guy, right? So Subban likes to be a little bit adventurous at times offensively, and I think it allows him to feel confident that Georges can defend a little bit better than Markov can. So that's going to be your top four, what the Jets are going to face. When you look at the Habs up front, you look at a talented, a fast, but a small center core. As you look at Desharnais, Plekanec, Eller, I mean, these are guys that can all move the puck. They can all stick handle, they can all pass, but and Plekanec is one of the best two-way centers in the National Hockey League, who to me doesn't get enough attention for how effective he is. And of course, Jets fans know Lars Eller has been a Jets killer in the past. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the Jets the way they're constructed with Scheifele and with Jokinen, the size of the centers should be something that the Jets can take advantage of. And if you watch the Habs against very big teams, you know, for example, Ottawa last year in the playoffs, if you can keep them on the outside, which they don't mind playing because they're smaller guys, then you can have success against them. What you can't do against Montreal is turn the puck over in the neutral zone and allow them to have their three forwards attack quickly, because they're fast.
Similar to what we said last Saturday against Toronto, the Jets couldn't.
Yeah, they're similar in that respect. Now the Habs will. They possess the puck a little bit more, and what I mean by that is if Kessel gets Kessel intercepts the puck, or Van Riemsdyk, they're going to go up and they're going to take a great shot, a great opportunity. The Habs might kill you by taking the puck in the zone, the neutral zone, and then starting an attack in the offensive zone, and, you know, by possession a little bit more, because they're not someone's big enough to get to the net. But it's the speed element of how quickly they can transition. You know, if you watch Vancouver last night, not as much of a worry, guys. I mean, Vancouver's not going to kill you in transition. They're not fast enough, right? I mean, Sedin. A guy like Daniel Sedin, for example, is not going to be a guy who steals a puck and goes by you. He's going to be a guy who gets a puck and weaves his way and finds a seam.
Mm-hmm.
Not the situation with the Habs. They're going to be more of a speed team. You look at Pacioretty. You look at Plekanec, as I mentioned. Gallagher is an interesting one in that he'll go to the net, but he's not the biggest guy. And even they're tough guys. And you mentioned, as like a guy, Rene Bork, not necessarily a tough guy, but he can engage. He can skate. Brandon Proust, who is their tough guy, he can skate too. So everybody on this team can skate. So you have to make sure you guard against stupid mistakes in your own zone and the neutral zone.
It's really interesting. Today, Christian Thomas is playing for the Habs. That's Steve Thomas's son, of course, the assistant coach of the Lightning. So it's kind of a neat way for him to make his NHL debut playing against his dad on the other side. So I thought that was pretty interesting, too.
Is this a game, it always seems to circle back to Dustin Byfuglien and the Jets' third line. Is this a game tomorrow that fits what they do best, or is this going to be too fast for them to really keep up?
The Jets can keep up with teams.
I meant the third line. I meant Dustin Byfuglien specifically. Sorry.
That's a fair question. And, I mean, the thing about Setoguchi, Setoguchi can skate. I mean, Jokinen's not going to be the fastest guy on the team, but he's not the slowest guy on the team either. You know, he's a little older now. But and when Buff gets going, it takes him a while to get going. So it depends on how you play against him, right? If the pace is back and forth, they will be. They generally have trouble with that for over the past since they've been together. But if they can get the puck down low, you know, Emelin and Georges will be the guys, and Doug Murray, those guys will be the guys that Montreal relies on to defend down low. But conversely, if you have a trouble with speed almost always in the NHL, then you're big, because if you're not big and you're not fast, you have a hard time making the NHL.
Sure.
So the Jets should be able with that line to create some havoc below the hash marks. Now, what happens sometimes with that line is Jokinen loses patience and fires the puck blindly up front, and we don't know why. But with Setoguchi's shot, with Byfuglien's release, and with the size of Byfuglien and Jokinen, they can take advantage of that against this team, because the Habs, they actually aren't small on defense, because Emelin's tough, Georges is tough, and Murray's huge. But the other guys, you know, Markov, you can certainly turn the corner on, and Subban does jump out of position at times.
And a team like the Montreal Canadiens, I've found in the past, the Jets really have... They really haven't kind of played, you know, the quote unquote dirty game. And against the Montreal Canadiens, they're going to be playing their second game of a back to back afternoon game, and that you know is something that you can't capitalize on. And you know the Jets yesterday, you know, the thing right now is I don't necessarily like it, but for Paul Maurice right now, he's really only using three lines. He barely used the fourth line at all yesterday. So you're going to see
a good point.
You're going to see a situation tomorrow where really it's not going to be easy to go in there and steal a couple points, but the Jets, you know, for all purposes, they're really going to have to play a smart defensive game, and they have been. And I mean, you're going to see the Bogo Enstrom pairing going up against the Balkanic line, and you're going to see Stewart and Trouba probably against the Desharnais line. And
but you don't mind probably switching those. I mean, you wouldn't care too much if those lines had to play different, if those defense pairings switched, right? Meaning, like, if they played against the other lines.
Right. And, you know, the speed element, I mean, Dustin Byfuglien arguably had his best game as a forward last night. I thought he was really good.
That's fair.
He's not playing as much, and it's a different type of adjustment for him. And, you know, that line is when the Jets have those three lines going, you obviously want all four lines going, mm-hmm. but Paul Maurice isn't really using the fourth line right now. And depending on who they play, they use the fourth line a little bit more against Nashville, but against a team like Vancouver, who's obviously a more talented team than the Nashville Predators, didn't go to the fourth line a lot. So it's going to be a tough game. Like you mentioned it, Drew, the Jets have struggled against the Habs. The Habs, you know, are a team right now that they're starting to get back to where they were before, and they have a lot of players that can burn you, and their special teams aren't maybe where they're at before, but a guy like PK Subban right now, he's not that far off of where he was last year as a Norris Trophy winner. And Richie mentioned he's not playing with Markov right now, and that might not actually be a bad thing, because that will maybe allow Markov to improve his game, because he's struggling. He's going to the Olympics with Russia, and you know, he's a key part of that team. He's always been a key part of the power play there, and their power play hasn't been as good as it was in past years. But you know, it'll be a tough one. I'm not going to make a prediction, but
we'll do that later.
The Jets have had trouble in Montreal.
Safe to assume that it'll be Peter Budaj in net for the Habs tomorrow, as Carey Price is playing against the Lightning right now. The game is at 12 noon tomorrow. You can hear it live on TSN 1290. Let's go to break, and when we come back, we're going to look ahead to the Winnipeg Jets' schedule for the remainder of the season and try and crunch the numbers to determine how many points it'll take for them to make the playoffs. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
10 minutes before the top of the hour, this is TSN 1290. We are The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel in studio with Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, looking ahead to the remaining Jets schedule and trying to do some mathematics to see what it's going to take for them to make the playoffs.
on today, the beginning of February, the 1st of February, the Jets are 6 points back of Vancouver.
Back?
That was back. I don't know what I was going with there.
You're thinking of Dennis back?
Yeah. 6 points back of Vancouver and 7 points back of Minnesota.
And they're 490s back of the playoffs.
Those two teams represent the two wild card teams in the Western Conference. Both the Jets, the Canucks, and the Minnesota Wild all have 26 games remaining. Yeah. In addition, the Jets are tied with the Dallas Stars, 1 point behind the Nashville Predators, 3 points behind the Phoenix Coyotes. Phoenix and Dallas have 28 games remaining, 2 games in hand on the Jets. The Jets and the Predators have played the same number of games. There's 52 points left available for the Winnipeg Jets this season. That's 26 games times 2, 52 points. How many will they need to make the playoffs, in your opinion? How many of those 52 points are they going to need to make the playoffs?
Well, right now, the speculation, or I guess the number that has been thrown out there is 100 points, and it looks like it's probably going to be a little bit less than that now.
Too high.
I think you're going to be somewhere in between probably 95 and 98 points, I think would be a little bit more fair, because the teams that are in the bottom of the bottom playoff spots right now, Minnesota and Vancouver, have trailed off a little bit. We talked about Vancouver, 3 wins in their last 10 games. But I think being conservative even, I think you're probably looking at 95 points.
Yeah, so 95. To be conservative,
if you're going to be a little bit, a little bit overzealous, maybe you'd say 98 or 99. So if the Jets right now are sitting at 57 points and you need 95 points and, 95 minus 57 is 38, if I can do some math really quickly in my head.
The son of a mathematician there.
My dad will be happy that I can do basic arithmetic. But if you're looking at, that amount of points and you've got 20, as we mentioned, 26 games left,
19-7.
You're most likely going to have to win 18 of those games.
19-7.
Or 19 of those games, right?
If you take out the overtime log.
So you're looking at, you got to win 70% of your games, 75% of your games.
Of the 26 games the Jets have remaining, 7 of those games are against the teams that they're chasing for the final playoff spots. They have 1 game against Nashville, 2 games against Phoenix, 1 game against Minnesota, 2 games against Dallas, and 1 game against Vancouver. Do you think the Jets almost have to win those 7 games to make it?
I look at it a little bit differently, Drew. If I look at their schedule, I look at the teams that are, to me, clearly better than they are. And then I say, okay, they're probably not going to win those games. So then they have to win every other game. I mean, to simplify it a little bit, if you look at the schedule, I mean, if you want to say the St. Louis Blues are one loss just based on skill level, right? St. Louis Blues are one loss.
Mm-hmm.
The Kings haven't played very well. The Kings are 2 losses. And then you look, there's the Blues again. Say that's 3 losses. And the Sharks, Kings, and Ducks, okay? So I'm just going to go, although LA hasn't played as well, Sharks, Kings, and Ducks. So right there, St. Louis twice, the Kings twice, the Sharks, and the Ducks. That's 6 losses right there. Okay?
Yeah.
Then you look at the Penguins and the Bruins and Boston. Okay, so that's 8 losses. And they have to go basically 19-7 to give them a shot at 95 points. So any teams that aren't those teams, you have to beat. Now, I know it's simplifying. They could beat those teams. But just from this perspective, any teams that aren't those teams, you have to beat, and you almost have to beat one of those teams to give yourself a good shot.
So you have to, you have to steal.
Any other games, you have to win. I mean, you have to beat the Carolinas, and you have to beat Ottawa's, you have to beat Colorado's, you have to beat the Stars. Those are all games you got to win.
Richie makes a good point, but if you want to kind of flip it around and maybe look at it from a different perspective, the Jets have beat the Hawks this year. They've beat the Blues this year.
Absolutely.
They've beat the Kings this year. They've beat the Ducks this year. Those are all very good teams.
They beat the Sharks
West.
This year also. Early in the year.
They did beat the Sharks. You're right. Earlier in the season. So you're talking about the top 6 teams in the West that they've beat. So Richie's looking at it, and Richie is looking at it from the way you should look at it. He's looking at it from you're probably going to lose the games against the teams that are much higher than you in the standings. But then they've lost to the Flames.
Well,
they've lost,
But when you have you have to beat those teams,
right.
Those teams are playing for something too. Doesn't mean that every game isn't important, but when the San Jose and LA and Anaheim are battling it out for who's going to have home ice advantage in the playoffs, and that game means a lot to them near the end of the season, and they're going, it's a lot harder to play them than the random game in the middle of January.
And Richie, you mentioned 19-7, right? And obviously 19-7 is a tall task. And you start with the four games on the road here before the Olympics. And, you know, you're going to play three of those games against Eastern Conference opponents. The Jets have been better against Eastern Conference opponents and have really been awful this year in their own division. Sure, they beat the Hawks and their record is a little bit better. But earlier in the season, that was really why they got off to such a bad start. They had so many games in their own division. And you look at the Canadians and the Hurricanes, and right now they're playing pretty well. The Hurricanes, you got to give them credit. They're sticking around in seventh, and I don't know if they'll stay there, but right now they're playing pretty well, and the Capitals are a mess. So, you know, is it realistic to say the Jets win three out of those four games? I don't know, but really, if you want to make those chances, again, you look at 19-7. 19-7 gets a lot better if you win the games earlier on, and you don't put yourself in a situation where you have to win five or six games in a row.
You know, you look at these games, and again, that's a simplified look at what we're talking about in terms of the schedule. But if you have to go on that five-game road trip, Stars, Sharks, Kings, Ducks, Coyotes.
Is coming up in March.
Yeah, the end of March, early April. It's a lot harder when you have to win five in a row to make yourself feel than having bank points against teams that aren't that good.
You have to, that's why you have to sort of create a buffer for yourself as opposed to making every single game a must-win game when the schedule gets harder. Because, I mean, the schedule isn't the most difficult obviously they have the big break, but it's not the most difficult for the next, say, 10 games.
That's right. It's not that hard.
You got the Canadians on the who are playing the second half of a back-to-back tomorrow. You got the Hurricanes, the Capitals. You would expect you're better than both those teams. St. Louis, that's a tough game, but you got the Phoenix Coyotes at home, where you've already beaten them at home. They look like a team that's in some degree of disarray.
Yeah, not as much anymore, but they got them at a good time before.
You got the Predators in Nashville. That'll be a difficult game. On the Saturday afternoon, beginning of March. Islanders at home. That's the right before the trade deadline. Is Thomas Vanek still a member of the Islanders by that point in time?
Fair point.
The Los Angeles Kings. Well, they can't seem to score so far. So, what's going on with the Los Angeles Kings?
Again, they're playing them the day after the trade deadline, guys, and they could have that score on their team. Apparently, they have rumored interest in Sam Gagner and some other guys. So
they've been linked to Matt Molson, allegedly,
and Camilleri,
as well. Yeah. So, I mean,
both of those guys who they've had in the past, Molson and Camilleri.
That's right. Yeah. The schedule gets a lot harder as you get later on, as you get to the middle of March.
Yep.
So you take advantage of it's not soft, but take advantage of the easier of the two parts of the schedule, if you want to divide them in half, and go on another 8-2 run in the next 10 games, give or take, and then you have a little bit more of a buffer, like you were saying, in which that you can play with when you're playing the really hard teams, the Sharks, the Kings, the Ducks, the Coyotes, at the end of March, beginning of April.
Well, you're right, Drew. That road trip is going to be a hard one, and you have to think that if you come back from that road trip and you win three of five games, that's a successful road trip because those are some really good teams. So the Jets have won 7 out of 9 games under Maurice, and they've put themselves in a position where they're still relevant in the playoff race. And we couldn't say that after that fifth loss in a row, and which cost Claude Noel his job. So right now, they've put themselves in a situation where this now becomes a very crucial part of the season. Whereas before, they were kind of coasting and really falling just game by game out of the playoff race. So it's nice that they've put themselves in a position that this road trip, especially starting off against these three Eastern Conference opponents, which, Montreal and Carolina are playing pretty well, but they can set themselves up nicely for after the Olympic break. If they're, still 5, 6, even 7 points out of the playoff race, there's still a chance. And if you only win one of these games, then it's really becomes impossible to make the playoffs, because then you're talking about 19-7, all of a sudden there's 22 games left, and then you have to go 18-4.
Keep in mind, I'm giving the Kings more credit based on track record than I am the Avalanche, but the Avalanche have been better than the Kings this year overall, and they play the Avalanche twice too.
It all gets underway tomorrow, 12 noon, the Jets and the Habs as the start of the key 4-game road trip. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to look around the NHL at some transactions, trades, and signings. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're listening. listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. We mentioned it last segment that Jets' key road trip, San Jose, Los Angeles, Anaheim, Phoenix, March 26th through April 2nd. You too can be on that road trip with the Winnipeg Jets. Qualifying starts on Monday for TSN 1290's Ultimate Game Day Getaway California Edition. You and a friend jetting off to see the Jets play San Jose, Los Angeles, Anaheim, Phoenix. 4 nights of hard-hitting action along with guest appearances on TSN 1290 and $2,000 in spending money. How about that? That's a nice little trip for this cold in the winter. Qualifying 4 times daily, 7:15, 8:15, 12:15, and 5:15. Travel provided by redtag.ca, where Canada shops for great deals. It's the TSN 1290 Ultimate Game Day Getaway California Edition. Qualifying gets underway on Monday. Gentlemen, not only would it be good to win that prize, but it's good to be Colorado Avalanche goaltender Semyon Varlamov right now. He just signed a contract extension a couple days ago. It's a 5-year contract extension. It's worth $29.5 million. He's having a great season under Patrick Waugh, his tutelage there in Colorado. 26-9-5 record so far this year with a 2.43 goals against average. The average annual value of this contract, the salary cap hit, is $5.9 million. What do you think about this signing for the Colorado Avalanche, teeing up their goaltender of the future for 5 years?
A little bit surprised, Richie, that they gave him 5 years. But, you know, you mentioned that Patrick Waugh under his tutelage, and also Francois Allaire, who, very famous goalie coach, who worked with Patrick Waugh. And then we know that he was run out of Toronto a little bit there. But that's okay, because Rick St. Croix is a good guy, good goalie coach. But he's really flourished under Francois Allaire in Colorado. And he's on pace for his best year. I think he already has the most wins he's ever had in his career. But Varlamov was criticized heavily, and he didn't have a good year, but the Colorado Avalanche, as we know, were a complete mess last year, and they obviously lucked out, and not lucked out, but they were able to draft Nathan MacKinnon and really turn around their fortunes quickly here, and now they're in the middle of a playoff race, and they might even get a home playoff spot. But, you know, he's an excellent goaltender, and he's still at 25 years old. He's still, you know, really, to me, I don't think we've really seen the best of Varlamov, but he's had a season, and they've obviously decided, Richie, that they want to lock him up now for 5 years, because J.S. Jaguar is towards the end of his career, and you have to imagine that they're probably going to acquire a backup either in the off season or maybe bring up a goaltender from their system. But yeah, a little bit surprised, Drew, that they gave him 5 years. You know, we kind of talked about it last week about Steve Mason. See, to me, 3 years isn't as much of a concern, but they're obviously confident enough in Varlamov to give him the 5-year contract. And I'd have to think a guy like Patrick Waugh, who's heavily influential in this decision, sees what he likes, and they've locked him up.
These contracts are very odd. I mean, he's coming in, he's finishing his third year of his second deal.
He's a UFA at the end of the season.
No, he's not. He wasn't. He was an RFA at the end of the year. He had 6 years accrued, so he was an RFA.
Okay, sorry. I thought I must have read that wrong then.
Yeah, so he's an RFA. So, I mean, that's why it's kind of odd. I mean, you know, so he kills you in arbitration. Is he going to get more than $5.9 million in arbitration? Likely not, and there's a threat of him leaving, and then that's an issue. He's had flashes of brilliance, and I think he's a talented netminder. Goaltending is a difficult position to project, difficult position to analyze. So this is where I defer a bit, and I defer to Patrick Waugh. Because Patrick Waugh is not only the head coach, not only but a Hall of Fame netminder. And if he thinks that this guy has what it takes to be a great netminder, he has a role as not only a coach, but he's part of the personnel decisions there too. That was part of his contract. I can be convinced by Patrick Waugh, by this action, that he thinks that Varlamov has the ability to be that dominant netminder. And if he thinks that, I mean, who am I to say that he doesn't? And he isn't, because, as he mentioned, sure, it's been half of a season that he's been this good for, but he has had glimpses of success in the past, and people have always said he's physically very capable. So it's an aggressive move. It's one that puzzles me a bit at the timing, but Patrick Waugh, if you think he's going to be your core guy, and that's one of the trends you're seeing. Patrick Waugh, Sakic, all those guys, if you think they're going to be your core guys, you want to lock them up. Matt Duchene's locked up for $6 million a year. Landeskog's locked up for $5.5 million a year. And now they're locking up Varlamov in that core. This is what they think the core is of the team. And he's the right age. I mean, he can be a great goalie. He's the right age to be a good goalie and get better.
Yeah. Unlikely he's going to regress because he's only 25, so it's not like it's going to age should be a factor in this contract. To me, I think it's a little bit much money, but I can live with it. What I like is that he's putting up good numbers this year behind a defense that is, I would say, average at best.
Yeah, that's being generous.
Yeah, being generous. So he's doing this without you can't say because he's playing in front of Chris Pronger and Scott Niedermeyer.
That's a good point.
So if that defense continues to improve, I think you can make an argument that logically his numbers might even get better.
It's fair.
And at which point in time it might, I don't think it's ever going to look like a bargain, but I think the contract will look even more tolerable a couple years down the road if that team's defense improves.
No, it's a good point, Drew. He's got the second most saves in the NHL, and you mentioned that right now that's a young defense, and it's basically led by Eric Johnson, and Jan Hayda is a veteran, a pretty underrated defense when he was good with Edmonton for many years, but Corey Sarich was brought in the offseason. He's done a nice job, but that's probably a team moving forward towards the trade deadline going into the playoffs. I imagine Colorado is another team that they'd love to get, pick up a defenseman there. And there were rumors that they might have been interested in bringing back like a guy like John Michael Lyles or somebody like a puck moving defenseman. Yeah. They need that. Yeah. But you're right, Drew. Varlamov has done everything. And for talk about Varlamov, a guy who was having those legal issues, that whole business, a couple months later, he's getting a 5-year contract. So his fortunes have really turned around there. And it's nice for him because
that's for sure.
For a guy like Varlamov, again, he comes over from Washington and he was okay in his first year, but they gave up the first round picks, right?
They did.
So there was a lot of pressure on him.
And it ended up, I believe, Philip Forsberg, who ended up being traded for Martin Nerat. So maybe
the trade looks a lot better.
Yeah. Isn't it ironic that it?
I believe
for another Forsberg.
Yeah. But I think back to the idea of core. Right, you're paying the core. You're not paying the periphery guy. I think what they're going to build around is Duchene, Landeskog, MacKinnon, Varlamov, O'Reilly. I think they get done. I think Stastny's probably on his way out. Guys like Tan, they want to trade Parento. Everybody knows that now. Jamie McGinn's been rumored to be on the block. And Tanguay is, he's got 2 more years left. He's obviously had injury troubles. But you see, teams that pay their best players are in better shape than teams that sometimes pay their best players, other times don't, and then pay their fringe guys more than they should. If your best players are getting paid, the rest of it will take care of itself.
Before we move on.
So Chicago's done so well. Now, they draft and they do other things, but they pay their best players. Keith, Seabrook, Taves, Kane, Hossa, their best players get paid, they'll fill the rest. It's a lot easier to do it that way.
Would you rather have Semyon Varlamov at 5 years and $5.9 million, or would you rather have Sergei Bobrovsky at 2 years and $6.25 million?
Can you compare the term? I mean, what does Sergei Bobrovsky make over those five years? Does he kill it on his next contract and then make 6.5 and then make up the I don't know. So it's a little bit surprising, but I trust in Patrick Waugh's ability to evaluate net mining far more than I do a lot of other people. Net mining is very hard to predict, guys. I mean, we've seen it so many times. Who knows who's going to be great? People wait on Devan Dubnyk. People waited on Steve Mason. I don't think they've seen the jury still out on that one. People are in this city are waiting on Andre Pavlik. And how many people really know goaltending?
Right, and when you talk about goaltending in the sense that you can kind of fluctuate in your confidence and all that, I think there's a lot of concern amongst GMs in the National Hockey League that they don't want to lose a guy that they know can play. Varlamov is going to end up playing 60 or 65 games a year. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a concern amongst GMs when they're not concerned, but this factors in, Richie, to their analysis when they say, okay, what if we decide not to sign Varlamov? Who's gonna come in and fill that role for us? Who's gonna play equally to that? And sure, there are only a select few of elite goalies in the NHL. I think Varlamov is maybe just on the cusp of the elite. I don't know if he's an elite. He's definitely a bona fide number one goaltender. Uh-huh. But when they're looking, when Joe Sakic is looking at this, he's saying, okay, well, if we're not signing Varlamov, Jaguar is only going to play for a couple more years. Who are we going to bring in that's going to give us that level of goaltending,
that's
right?
That's a great point. Look at Tampa Bay. Everybody talks, oh, you know, you can get it on the cheap. Well, they wasted a year with Lindback. They wasted a year looking for other guys. I mean, it's easy. You can find the goaltender anywhere. But you literally waste seasons of players' prime years when you can't find a netminder to backstop.
Right. So you can look at either whether it's Europe, and you can look at leagues and you can say, well, you know, Rado Barra was great in the Swiss league. Well, when he comes over to the NHL, you know, he's not one of the top goaltenders in the NHL. So I'm not picking on him. I'm just saying, to be an elite goaltender in the NHL, there's only 30 guys that can be number one. And even some of the number one guys in the NHL aren't really number ones. Right. They're forced to be number ones because of injuries and all that. So I think that, you know, you're looking at it, you're saying, oh, well, Varlamov, 5 years, that's a lot of years. You know, how good of a goaltender is he? Well, he's a pretty darn good goaltender. And they're saying, I think he can even be better if we, as you said, maybe add a veteran defenseman, you know, kind of make his job a little bit easier. Because right now you have a lot of teams, you know, you talk about trades, Drew, a bunch of guys on the block. Right now, I think the one thing that is in probably short supply versus in high supply, there's a lot of offensive players, a lot of forwards that, you know, they're looking to move. But a lot of the amount of teams that are looking for, you know, like a puck-moving veteran left-side defenseman, the Jets are one of those teams.
Yep.
There's, you know, there's 15 teams looking for that. And when you have that on your team, you don't want to give it up.
Yeah, the other aspect, too, we talk about, you know, locking up your best players. It's also having them grow together. And you tell them these are the guys, these five guys, six guys. You are who we are building around. They forge bonds based on that as well, and that kind of continuity and security allows them to ingrain themselves in the community a little bit more, and it gives them a certain confidence, I think, to their game as well. So I think all those things need to be taken into account.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll update you on the New York Rangers' Ryan Callahan contract negotiations. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at TSN 1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants of Manitoba. The Certified General Accountants Professional Accounting Designation opens doors of unlimited career opportunity and financial reward. For more information, contact the CGA Association at cga-manitoba.org. Certified General Accountants, we see more than numbers. Gentlemen, right now, New York Rangers general manager Glenn Sather and Ryan Callahan, the Rangers captain, are seeing more than numbers. They're seeing some trade scenarios. They're seeing some contract negotiations. It's a situation that is unfolding quickly and sort of somewhat in public, oftentimes more in public than a lot of these negotiations unfold. The latest is that the New York Rangers have established this Friday's trade freeze, the trade freeze that's going to go into effect because of the Sochi Olympic Games. They've established this Friday's trade freeze as the time of decision regarding Ryan Callahan's future. Is he going to re-up with the New York Rangers? Is he going to be a trade candidate when the trade freeze lifts? As we discussed, and we discussed on Wednesday's NHL Midweek Show, Ryan Callahan is looking for 7 years and $42 million from the New York Rangers. That's what he has asked for in order to re-sign with the Rangers. The Rangers are willing to go 5 years, and I believe it was $25 or $30 million.
In the latest, it said 30.
So at that point in time, they've agreed almost, if that report is to be taken as accurate, they've agreed that we're willing to pay you $6 million a year. And that's what Callahan wants. The dispute at this point in time is over the length of term. Callahan wanting 7 years, the Rangers only wanting it to be a 5-year term. Supposedly on the trade market, the Rangers have granted permission to Ryan Callahan's agent to negotiate with one team. As in, if you can, you know, you can negotiate with that team, we'll see if we can make a trade, and then you can sign a contract with the team. Supposedly, the Rangers are interested in St. Louis Blues winger Chris Stewart as a first step in a two-step process that will see Chris Stewart become a New York Ranger, and then in the offseason, Paul Stastny becomes a unrestricted free agent, and the Rangers would sign him to a contract. How do you see the Callahan New York Rangers saga ending, and is he long for New York Rangers blue shirts?
I mean, 7 years, $42 million for Ryan Callahan? I mean, come on. My God, I know he's the heart and soul of the team and all that stuff. You want to know, you can't just identify a player's, a number the player is worth based strictly on points. Do you want to know how many points is his highest scoring season?
Please.
54 points, guys. 54 points. You're going to give him 7 years and $42 million?
Let me stop you right there. Would you give him 5 years and $30 million?
The report is that they would give him 5 years, $30 million, be based on similarity of Joel Pavelski. That's what Larry Brooks writes in the New York Post. I think he's worth more like 5 years, 25, 5 years, 27 and a half, frankly. New York wants to give him based on what he's worth, fine. He is a smaller guy who's a heart and soul guy. I have so much respect for the way he plays. But let's not complicate matters. Let's not cloud the fact that you pay your best players. We said it last segment. You pay your best players. He's one of their best players, but is he going to produce? Can you sign a guy like that for 7 years to $6 million a year? I realize the cap's going up and all that stuff. Do you know he's not going to wear down? He sacrifices his body. He plays hard. But there's a wear and tear on that style. It's a lot of money. It's more than Blake Wheeler's making.
Going to be 29 years old on March 21st.
More than Blake Wheeler's making. Blake Wheeler had one more RFA year. That's more than Blake Wheeler's making.
Has he?
Blake Wheeler's better than Ryan Callahan.
I when you look at 7 years at $42 million, it's a lot of money. But, as we talked about on the midweek show, if you look at, I don't know, is it relative? Is it similar to what other guys are making? When you look at some of the other contracts that have been thrown out to players, whether it's David Clarkson or Ryan Clough, it might be a lot, but maybe that's, I guess you're paying a little bit more for his service to the team. So I guess the compromise here is, a 6-year contract with, I guess, a less of a cap hit, but it'll be interesting to see what happens here. They've been floating out all of these names and situations. I think that's maybe just to kind of play it out and maybe put some more pressure on their camp, but I see Callahan signing, and I'm not sure if he'll get as much, but it seems like there's a compromise to be had here.
What do you think? Let's say that the deal, they don't find a middle ground, and they decide that they're going to go the trade route.
Yeah.
What do you think about Chris Stewart for Ryan Callahan and the supposed plan to then reunite Chris Stewart with Paul Stastny, who he had his greatest success so far in his career with?
Success of Chris Stewart and Paul Stastny. I'm hitching my wagon to Chris Stewart and Paul Stastny. Paul Stastny is not the player he was a few years ago. He's cleaned it up a bit and he's a little bit better. But I mean, Paul Stastny, can you have a team in New York in this day and age with the style of play that has employed the National Hockey League, Yezzy, with Brad Richards and Paul Stastny as your number one and number two centers, and with Stepan in there as well. So there's your three centers who just can't skate. Richards and Stastny are not good enough skaters to keep up. Can you have two of those guys who are similar players? I don't think that's, I don't mind the Chris Stewart thing. You might get a good game out of Chris Stewart at once every three games. He can skate and he's a big boy. He's not Ryan Callahan. I don't mind that as a return if you have a plan for Stewart, but I just don't. I don't think building it around Stewart and Stastny is something where it's going to get you a cup.
Chris Stewart had his greatest success in 2009, 2010 with the Colorado Avalanche when he had 64 points in 77 games. Ezzy, what are your thoughts on Chris Stewart as a potential return for Ryan Callahan?
I don't see it happening. And, as far as getting Paul Stastny, that's assuming that he's not traded. Are a free agent, so they're expecting him to become a free agent. Well, what if he gets traded? Then that kind of master plan doesn't really work out. But Chris Stewart for Ryan Callahan, I guess different types of players. Chris Stewart probably has, I guess, a similar amount of offensive upside. But again, Ryan Callahan's the captain of the team, and again, what he does.
Stewart's not going to be your captain, right? Yeah.
It's a different type of different role and situation. So I think right now, even though the reports could be out there, I think that they're just trying to basically create contingency plans in case Callahan isn't signed. But I do expect him to be signed.
We should note Stewart's under contract for one more year at 4.1.
Right.
But, I mean, Chris Stewart, do you know what you're getting?
Well, you're getting a – I mean, you know what kind of game you're getting. You're getting a big guy who plays, you know, who's a power forward, but who can often disappear for not only shifts and not only one game, but he can disappear for games at a time. I mean, he's got 0 points in his last five games for the St. Louis Blues. So, I mean, this is a guy who's, you know, should probably perform better than he has been. Still, he's younger than Callahan. He's only 26 years old. He'll be 27 in October. So he's got youth on his side. But, I mean, like you said, you know, Paul Stastny is, you know, towards the end of his NHL career, I would suggest, at this point in time.
Well, he just, I mean, he sees the game really well, Paul Stastny. But I don't think in Colorado's long term, as even you have McKinnon and you have Duchesne and you have O'Reilly, I mean, you can play all three of those guys at center. You could play them at wing too if you want to, but you can play them all at center. That flexibility is great. Callahan was having a good year last year, of course, in the lockout year, 31 points in 45 games. But is this a guy you can pay big money to long term? And I think you can pay big money to long term within reason. And maybe what's Glenn Saylor's doing, Glenn Saylor's not going to back off of the agents. He's been doing this for 40, 50 years at this point. One thing you need to know is if he lets them talk to Doug Armstrong, Ryan Callahan's agent, talk to Doug Armstrong in St. Louis, and Doug Armstrong comes in and says, "Yeah, okay, we'll give you 5 years, you know, $30 million." Then Callahan knows, "Hey, I'm probably worth that. I'm probably worth that, and maybe to another really good team." Doesn't mean that some team won't David Clarkson him and give him too much money because he's available and they're desperate. But it does mean he gets an idea of what he's worth to other teams. And it might be what he's the same thing he's worth to the Rangers. And if he's worth the same thing to St. Louis Blues as he is to the Rangers, why would he uproot everything?
It's not a bizarre situation that he's letting his agent talk to other teams without the trade having been, you know, formalized?
Well, I think it should happen more often, frankly. Because you're allowing the Rangers to get more for you. So, but he also said it's news to him in the story this morning. So Callahan said it's news to him. May not be news to Steve Bartlett, his agent, but it's news to him. So who knows? They're playing some games here. It's New York City. Maybe it's not. It's not. You know, it's not Winnipeg here. They're playing the media hard.
Are the New York Rangers a better team with Chris Stewart and Paul Stastny, or with Ryan
and Paul Stastny? Yeah, but I mean, well, how much is it going to cost you to sign Paul Stastny? And then what is Stewart's next contract?
Are they a better?
It's complicated.
Are they a better team with Chris Stewart or with Ryan Callahan?
With Ryan Callahan, for sure.
Is he?
I'd say Ryan Callahan. No offense to Chris Stewart, but again, he's the captain of the team, and he's basically a jack of all trades. Ryan Callahan, and a fan favorite there, very popular player there. He'll be on the American Olympic team, but if we're doing straight up, I'll take Ryan Callahan.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Andrew Gross from the Bergen Record in New Jersey. Talk a little bit more about the situation unfolding in New York. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.